rendezvous, we were discussing the line of transmission of Torah. And we discussed why Pirkei Avos begins with tracing the origins of the Torah's Mesorah, handing over all the way back to Sinai. It's important that we recognize that the Torah was given in its entirety, each word, each letter, each nuance, the exact constellation of the notes were given over precisely by God to Moses. And we discussed how, as time progressed, we regressed, the minds diminished, and so the oral transmission ultimately had to be committed to writing in the times of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, which is why we have our Pirkei Avos, and why we have the Mishnah and the Talmud and the oral law. We also discussed why we emphasize the study of the oral law, and we discussed how, through trying to decipher each piece of Talmud, we are ascertaining what is God's real will, and we are thereby bonding with the divine, because the true source of any connection is intercourse of the mind, intellect, understanding, trying to understand what is in someone else's mind, what's important to them. How would they like me to conduct myself? That's the source of every connection. That's the most important medium of a connection. That's the bond that we have with Hashem, which is through Torah, which is why Torah is paramount, and it's the most important mitzvah of all the mitzvahs. Now we are going to touch upon a point that Alex, I think it was, brought up. Why the Mishnah tells us that Moshe accepted the Torah from Sinai and handed it over to Joshua,
right,
who handed it over to the elders. So there is a strange change in the expression of the Mishnah. Moses accepted the whole Torah from Sinai and handed it over to Joshua. And furthermore, the big question was, what does it mean he accepted the Torah from Sinai? He didn't accept it from Sinai, he accepted it from God. He accepted it from Hashem. Not from Sinai, from Mount Sinai. He happened to be geographically located at Mount Sinai. But that wasn't where he got the Torah from. Yes, Alex?
No, the other question I had was, it says he transmitted to Joshua, then Joshua to the elders to the prophets, and the prophets transmitted it. Why does it say transmitted again over there? What is up?
Oh, the chain. That's okay, because each time it's a good point. Masaruha.
No, but do you see? It says two.
Good.
And then the prophets transmitted again. Why did they have to transmit? Why not two?
Very good point. Very good point. There was a decisive drop in the level of spiritual connection that took place between the prophets that were on a much higher plane and the generations that preceded them to the men of the great assembly. That was when the galut, that's when the exile finally felt its strongest effect. And it was the men of the great assembly that determined that the Torah now, the oral law, has to be committed to writing. So it says again, even though each one gave it over with minimal evaporation, so to speak, with minimal loss as it went over, but from the prophets to the men of the great assembly, there was a significant, a precipitous drop in the transmission, and therefore they had to write it down. That's why that's recorded over there. But let's go back to our first point, because I want to touch upon this very important point. Why does it say that Moses accepted, not was handed over by God, but accepted the Torah from Sinai? And we discussed yesterday, if you recall, that Moses accepted the Torah in its entirety. In other words, there was nothing in the Torah that was hidden from him. And so the Talmud tells us in Shabbos, Daf Pei Ches, that when Moses went up to heaven, something that no other mortal ever was capable of doing, he went up to the top of the mountain, divested himself of his body, and his soul went up on high for 40 days and 40 nights. He was in heaven, the Torah tells us, and we believe this implicitly, that he went up to heaven for 40 days and 40 nights. And immersed himself and absorbed God's wisdom, so to speak, and accepted the Torah directly from God. And the Torah tells us that he did this three times, at three particular times. 40 days after the Torah was given, until the sin of the golden calf. 40 days from this 18th of Tammuz, after the sin of the golden calf, until the first day of Elul, and a final 40 days, which ended in Yom Kippur. So there were three times where he went up to heaven for 40 days.
Amazing.
And the first time when he went up to heaven for 40 days.
Oh my gosh.
He went up to heaven for 40 days.
120.
The first time when he went up to heaven, the Torah tells us that, the Talmud tells us that God taught him the entire Torah. And being that he was encased in a physical body, being that his soul was destined to return to a material body, there were finite limitations attached to his acceptance of the Torah. And he kept accepting the whole Torah into his mind chip, if you will call it that. But it kept getting lost. The brain kept freezing, and he kept losing the Torah until God gave it to him as a gift. But he was able to retain and absorb the entire Torah, all of God's wisdom, because he so morphed into God. He became such an integral part of what, of Hashem, that he was able to absorb Hashem's wisdom in its entirety, in its totality. He had the whole Torah. Even the secrets of the Torah, like the Red Haifa, and there are elements in the Torah which are denied us access, which we can't understand because we are in a limited mind frame, because we're encased in a physical finite body. Nevertheless, Moses in heaven was able to absorb and accept the whole Torah in its entirety. So it doesn't say that God handed over the Torah to Moses, because implicit in the word handing over, as something is handed over, something is lost. You know, when you pour a hot coffee from one cup to the other, some of the heat is lost. Something is going to evaporate in the process. And as something is handed over to someone else, it gets lost. We can only accept it with the vessel that we have. But when the Torah was given to Moses, it doesn't say God handed it over to Moses, because there was nothing lost in the transmission. Moses accepted the Torah in its entirety, in its totality. And how was he able to accept the whole Torah? Why was he distinct and different from everybody else that ever traversed the face of this world? Because he accepted the Torah because he had the attribute of Sinai. Mi Sinai, from Sinai. What was so distinct and what was so special about Mount Sinai? It was small. It was humble. There were many mountains that were vying for the honor of accepting the Torah. Mount Horeb, Mount Hermon, there are many mountains in Israel that said, God, you're going to give the Torah to the Jewish people. I have a beautiful ski slopes, and I have some very nice cliffs at the top, and I have a big plateau, and I stand up there 15,000 feet high or whatever. God said, precisely because you think you are something, I don't want to give the Torah on you. Mount Sinai was nothing more than a small little mountain, and it was humble. And therefore God says, on you I will give the Torah. And so the very first time when Moses was exiled from Egypt, and he was wandered with his flock, with his sheep, into the wilderness of Sinai from Midian, and he came to Mount Sinai, and God appeared to him in the burning bush. And God says to him, take out my people from Egypt. And Moses says, why? With what merit? What's the purpose? Why should I take out your people from Egypt? What are they going to, what exalted mission and destiny do they have that they need to be taken out from servitude? And God says, Tachas, because they are going to serve me on this mountain. And God points out the mountain, they're going to serve me. Do you know how they're going to serve me? They're distinct from everybody else because they will serve me with the characteristic of this mountain. They will be able to surrender and submit and exercise humility and thereby be able to bond with me. Because every bond, only the litmus test that determines the strength of any bond, is how much am I capable of surrendering and submitting in order to be a part of the other? Male, female. One has to submit to the other, and the other has to submit to the other in order to have a real bond and a real connection. And while we each assert our independence and we stand up for what we feel is right, then we are distant from one another. But just like Mount Sinai reflects that concept of submission, surrendering, even though I'm a mountain, I'm small, and I embrace my position in being small. So God says, I will give the Torah on those that reflect that same humility. Sinai is the emblem of humility. Just like God came down from heavens and gave the Torah at Mount Sinai, that wasn't simply coincidental. That Moses happened to be at that mountain at that time, and God says, okay, I'm going to give the Torah to the Jewish people right here. So therefore, go out and bring them here. And it's going to be a difficult exodus, but I'm going to empower you with this incredible mission. Go out there and bring them here. That wasn't what God said. What God was saying is, this is the end destination. And it's right here where I'm going to give you the Torah, that this is going to impassion and inflame the Jewish people with a mission for life, that they're going to resemble this burning bush, that they may be consumed with the fire of Golus, with the fire of exile, and all the nations will want to destroy them, but the burning bush will never be consumed. The Jewish people will live on with their faith and their connection. They can endure exile and persecution and tormentation, but nothing will break them. They are like the burning bush. Why? Because right here I'm going to give them the Torah. I'm going to give them the divine connection, the intimate, the marriage bond that is going to lock them to me under all circumstances. A marriage, once we sign that marriage contract and we go under the chuppah, come rain, come snow, come shine, come hail, come romance, come storms, it doesn't matter. The marriage endures.
In for life.
We're in for life. And a husband and wife get married under a chuppah because the chuppah resembles the home that they are going to build. A home that is open on all sides, that's all welcoming. A home like Abram and Sarah's tent. The mountain where God gave them the Torah was not a coincidental geographic location. It resembles the form of the connection that we have with God, which is based on our humility, our ability to be able to surrender to His divine will. Na'aseh v'nishma, that's our credo, that's our battle cry, and with that we went to accept the Torah. Na'aseh, we will do whatever you want, God. V'nishma, we will listen. There is no ego. There are no barriers. We're all yours. And so Moshe kibel Torah. Moses accepted the Torah above and beyond all the other Jews. Why? Misinai, because he had the character trait of humility. He had the character trait of Sinai. He was totally surrendered and submitted to God. He considered himself the lowest of all the Jewish people. He writes in the Torah, Moses says, Sheish meis elef ragli asher anochi bekirbo. He considered himself the lowest of all 600,000 Jews. And you may ask, how could that be? A leader that crushed the mighty Egyptian civilization, that wrought the greatest miracles that had been till now, that led the Jewish people out of Egypt, the one that was able to divest himself of his body and go up to heaven and come down, you wouldn't think he has a little bit of a... I'm some cool dude. I'm somebody. Come on, everybody adulates me. And everybody looked up to Moses and hung on to his every word. It says how it describes in the Torah how they gazed at him and looked at him as he went from the camp to his tent. He had an incredible power, incredible homage was paid and respects were paid to him. How could it be that he was the most humble of all men? How could it be that he was always like Mount Sinai and he considered himself the lowest of all the Jewish people? How's that possible? And the answer is that his humility was not like our humility. To us, humility means, okay, you want to do that to me? That's all right. Yes, okay, yes, you know, I'm a nobody. Whatever you want, all right. But that's not humility. Humility is not self-effacement, and it certainly is not expressed in low self-esteem.
Yeah.
We can be very conscious of who we are and what our destiny and mission is in life, but humility has all to do with recognizing that everything flows from the divine. And when we acknowledge and recognize that everything is permeated with the divine presence, that there is nothing other than him, then we have attained a measure of humility. We realize that even when I'm speaking now, even as my brain is processing thoughts, it's not me. Even as I smile, who's allowing my lips to twitch upwards? Every reflex, every action, every thought, everything that I am given at my disposal in this world is animated every second by God. I look at this bottle of water. True humility is someone who has yira, fear. Yira from the word seeing. And they see godliness. We see water that we're looking forward to quenching our thirst with. And we look at the label, and we look at the packaging, and we look at the advertising on it. We only see an external product. But someone that has genuine humility is capable of seeing Creator in creation, of seeing goodliness and godliness everywhere. And Moses was able to attain such a level of divestation from his body and from the material world that he saw good. So every Jew, he didn't look inside himself, he looked at every Jew and he saw godliness and he saw soul and he saw goodness. And so he considered himself, naturally, he was the lowest. He was able, being the lowest, he was able to lift everybody up from underneath. He was the most humble of all men. And so the divine spirit, the divine godliness rested inside of him. When he spoke, it was God speaking from within his throat, because there was no I as a barrier. There was no insulating material of the body and the ego that separated him from the divine. Moses accepted the Torah from Sinai. There was no I. His soul shone right through him. As we discussed in the past, his body was merely a piece of clear glass. His soul was incandescent. Nobody could look at him. He had to put a mask on his face because his soul shone through with such intensity, people couldn't even see or look at him. That was Moses. And naturally, therefore, he was the most humble of all men. You always find that. The greatest Torah scholars, the greatest real Torah scholars are the men that are the most humble in the world at large. Great people are interested in capturing the headlines. They take the plenum session, they take the keynote session at the big world conventions. They're sought after. After all, they're paid $50,000 or $100,000 for a speaking pop. And they consider themselves very, very important. They're not going to deal with little individuals that come by with their miniature problems. Look at all the great Torah sages. The greatest of the great were busy with individuals. They weren't trying to capture headlines. They weren't looking for publicity. Reb Moshe Feinstein, they found out at the end of his life, every Friday there was a woman in the east side, a Russian woman that didn't know English well. She used to bring her letters that she'd received from her son back in Russia that she needed translating from Russian to Yiddish. And he would translate them for her. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, people used to be able to come in with it to him and deal with their smallest, miniature, little Shalom Bayis problems, and he would deal with them so comfortably. You went into the great sages of yesteryear, they had no fancy apartments and no luxurious cars whisking them around with a security detail. I once went to Rav Shach's apartment. There wasn't a single chair that matched one another around the dining room table. And if you think there was a lampshade on the bulb hanging out of the ceiling, there wasn't. And these were the greatest luminaries in the Jewish people. But they weren't busy with themselves, and they weren't busy looking for headlines. So they were busy trying to help each individual. Because that's where it begins, that's where it ends. It's not about me promoting myself. In the world at large, it's all about press coverage and getting that promotional edge, making sure that my picture looks good and it's where it's located and how it's positioned and how I'm portrayed. Who isn't interested in any of that? My Rebbe, the Nesiva Shalom, was a great man. He shunned publicity, he abhorred any publicity. didn't want to. That's externalities. That's not important. What's important is who am I for real? I don't want to be compromised by being out there in the public eye. On the contrary, that almost contradicts the spiritual approach. So Moses was the greatest in that respect, that he was like the Mount Sinai. He was the most humble of all men. He wasn't looking to impress anybody. He was the genuine article. He was the real deal. He was totally submissive to God because he saw God everywhere, and he melted and morphed into the godliness that he saw. He recognized that he's just being given life and animated by Hashem. And so Hashem's divine wisdom naturally flowed inside of him to such a point, to such a degree, where he was just a vessel. There was no evaporation in the transmission process. He accepted the Torah in its entirety. Moshe kibel Torah miSinai. Moses accepted the Torah from Sinai. Very beautiful. He handed it over to Joshua. And so the Talmud tells us, Pnei Moshe ki Pnei Chama. The face of Moses was like the face of the sun. Pnei Yehoshua, the face of Joshua, ki Pnei Levana, was like the face of the moon. The moon just takes the reflection from the sun. Sometimes it captures the sun fully. Sometimes it only captures it half. Sometimes a little. Joshua, although he was completely submissive to Moses, and that's why he was the greatest of the Jewish people, he is described in the Torah as the Nahar, the simple man, the simple lad. He considered himself just a introductory student. Lo yamish mitoch ha'oil, he never left the tent. He hung on to Moses for every second that he could. He stood at the foot of the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights so that he shouldn't miss a second. When Moses comes down, he should be able to grab him right away and be with him. There was no greater student than Joshua. But nevertheless, he was like the moon. He wasn't an essential part of Moses. There was still an independent identity. He was just receiving the beams. He was receiving the infrared rays. And when you're receiving the beams, receptivity ebbs and wanes. It flows, it ebbs and flows. It's not a natural, automatic, total receptivity. And so something was lost when Moses died and Joshua took over. 300 laws were lost on that day. They had to be brought back through the oral process, the oral laws process. They had to be reconstructed, which we talked about yesterday. And so with each generation, more and more got lost. Until the generation of the prophets were the greatest of the great, but nevertheless, none of the prophets were able to attain the level of prophecy of Moses, as the Talmud tells us that Moses prophesied with the words Zehadava. He saw things in absolute clarity. Aspaklaria hameira. He saw things through a straight, clear piece of glass with no obfuscation whatsoever. All the other prophets saw their prophecy in a very unclear manner, and they had to interpret the vision that they saw. It's called an aspaklaria she'ena me'ira. And based on their level of spiritual receptivity and humility and greatness, that's the level of clarity that they saw in their vision. And sometimes it was so unclear, the prophet had to, in his most objective manner, because there was no negias, there was no self-interest, he was able to interpret exactly what he saw in the clearest way, in the clearest fashion possible. But nevertheless, the prophets were the great, great men that were able to see the past and the future. They were predominantly soul, and by extension, body. After the generation of the prophets, once prophecy was lost from the Jewish people, history took a nosedive, the Jewish history, and we have the men of the Great Assembly. After the destruction of the second temple, of the first temple, I'm sorry, when prophecy was lost from the Jewish people, the last of the prophets was Malachi, last of the Treasa. And when prophecy was lost and the men of the Great Assembly took over, there was an incredible loss of spiritual receptivity and knowledge, which is why the Torah, the Mishnah says, Masorua. Then there was another Masorah. They handed it over to the men of the Great Assembly. And it was the men of the Great Assembly that recognized that Torah had to be transcribed. And therefore, Heim Amru Shlosha Dvarim. They said three things. Ideally, they should be transmitted orally to one another. But we have them here in writing because they recognized, even though they should be said, and they wanted to maintain that ideal, that Torah should be said over from generation to generation, it was committed to writing. And that's where our Mishnah opens up. We're going to read the words of the men of the great assembly. What did they leave for posterity? It's written down for us, so we have it. Otherwise, it may have been lost. Yes.
The difference between Joshua and Moses is that Joshua lacked the degree of humility that Moses had. Is that
perfect?
Correct?
Yes.
And then something else, as far as the loss of the understanding of Torah as time from back when it was received to now. Do you think that has to do with the passage of time, or does that have to do with a change in the Jews?
It has to do with both. The passage of time, being that time is a finite limitation and we're under the dominion of time, so to speak, time does have an intolerable effect, yes. Time does have an effect, but it's almost like a Chinese whisper. As it goes on and we travel further and further from Sinai, it erodes, it gets weaker. Yeah, it's a combination of both. It's interesting, before we read exactly what the men of the Great Assembly told us, and before we just have a little insight as to who were the men of the Great Assembly, let me just share with you a concept, an idea of the humility of Moses. We talk about Moses being the most humble of all men. God says to Aaron and to Miriam, how do you speak against Moses? Moses is the most humble of all men. No man has ever attained the humility of Moses. So we look in the Torah and we are searching and scanning the Torah to see where do we find the humility of Moses. We see him as a very strong leader of the Jewish people. But if we read between the lines again and again, we will see a demonstration of his tremendous humility and his desire to give himself up for the Jewish people. Even after they err and they sin, he's willing to give up his life. He says, God, they sinned at the golden calf. If you're not going to forgive them, wipe me out from your sefer. I don't want to exist. I live for others. There was no I. But I noticed something that absolutely was the most, to me, it just hit me as something so powerful. Obviously, there are myriads of examples of Moses' humility. But to share with you just a little point which I saw last week, we read Parshas Korach. We read how Korach led an insurgency against Moses and Aaron. And who was the leader of this insurgency? Korach, Dathan, and Aviram. Korach, Dathan, and Aviram. Those were the three leaders. Dathan and Aviram were two very unsavory characters, which we find when Moses was a young man. Moses was now an old man. But when he was a young boy, and he was but 16, 17 years old, and he grew up in Pharaoh's palace, we find Dathan and Aviram first emerging on the scene. Moshe left the palace because he went out, he wanted to see the Jewish people's pain and travails and difficulties. He wanted to feel their pain. And so he left the comfort of the palace and he went out amongst the Jewish people. He looked, for all intents and purposes, like an Egyptian prince, but really he was the daughter of Yocheved. I'm sure you're familiar with the story. But the Torah tells us that he goes out, Vayar b'siv leisam, and he sees the pains and difficulties. And then he sees one Jew hitting another Jew. And he says to the Jew, Rasha! Lama sakariyecha, why do you hit your fellow Jew? And the guy says to him, they both say to him, Halahageini atoime. Are you going to take care of us like you took care of the Mitzri yesterday? Because the day before he saw an Egyptian hitting a Jew, and Moses was so bothered and perturbed, he zapped the Mitzri, he zapped the Egyptian. You read in the Torah, but no, he didn't have to kill him physically. He said God's name in a very powerful way, and the Egyptian just faded away. You read it in the Torah. I don't want to go into it right now. But doesn't, Halageni ato Omer. Are you going to say to kill me like you killed the Egyptian yesterday? Oh, wow. We won't go into that right now. But essentially, Dathan and Abiram turned on him. These were these two people that were fighting with one another. They were litigious people. They were people that were very argumentative. And they turned on him. And they said, "Ha ha, you killed the Egyptian yesterday. Are you going to do that to us?" And they spread the word that Moses killed an Egyptian. And Paro heard about it. And Paro was so incensed. "Moses, you killed an Egyptian taskmaster?" And because of Dathan v'Aviram spreading this Lashon Hara, this gossip, and telling everybody that Moses had killed the Egyptian, Moshe had to run away from the security of Paro's palace, and he had to run to Midian. He was in exile for over 60 years, away from his mother, away from his family, living in the most difficult circumstances. There's very little that the Torah tells us about that huge chunk of Moses' life. The Midrash talks about it at length. Talmud tells us a little. Fascinating. Very difficult years. Until the burning bush, when Moses was 80 years old, there are over 60 years of his life that were ruined, ostensibly, essentially, by Dathan and Aviram, by these two lowlives. Now, what do you think Moses, when he finally comes back and God empowers him and he's vindicated and now he's the leader of the Jewish people and he comes back to the Jews and he sees those two old stooges, those Dathan v'Aviram, they're still around? What do you think his attitude to Dathan v'Aviram would be?
He's like, "Why don't you
guys..." Oh, payback time. Now I'm the boss and I'm going to take care of you guys. That's what you would think, right? After all, they ruined his whole life, the most productive years of his life, from 17 to 80. Can you imagine? What would we want to do with Dathan v'Aviram? We want to bang their heads together till they collapse. Mm-hmm. Not so, Dathan v'Aviram lead the trouble every time there's an insurrection against Moses. And every time Moses goes over to Dathan v'Aviram and he's imploring them, "Please come, be reconciled. What can I do for you? Let's be part of the Jewish people." Finally, with Adas Korach, when they join Korach's rebellion against Moses and Aaron, what should Moshe be thinking? Moses, what should he be thinking? "Finally, we're going to get rid of Dathan v'Aviram for once and for all. These troublemakers, they're always fermenting rebellion." Moses is not like that. You see in the Torah, Moses goes over to Dathan v'Aviram. He's the great leader. They should come begging in humiliation to him. They should be licking his feet, begging for forgiveness. Moses picks himself up and he goes to the tents of those Dathan v'Aviram. And he says to them, "Please, please be reconciled. Do teshuva." And they turn aside in an angry way. They make fun and a mockery of Moses. Until the ground, finally Moses says, "There's no other way. I have no other way." And God, "Open up the ground, they should swallow them up." Which is what happens.
They made teshuva?
The sons of Korach did teshuva. They didn't do teshuva. Very fascinating. Here's a man, here you see the true litmus test of who we are. You know, finally, when someone really bothers us, we're happy to get them out of the way. We don't want to see them. Moses puts up with them. Not just puts up with them. He's hoping against hope that they will do teshuva and come back and be reconciled as an essential part of the Jewish people. It's fascinating. It made his life a total misery. But there was no I. Moses didn't live for himself. There was no traces of ego or self-importance or revenge, which is the ideal in our lives, that we erase the big I and thereby become bonded with the divine. Moses was able to realize that higher than any other human being. You see it in many other places in the Torah too. We won't go into that right now. But anyway, the Mishnah leads us to the sayings of the men of the Great Assembly, and they said three things. What were the three things the men of the Great Assembly said? Hevu musunim badin. Be deliberate in judgment. Be slow to render judgment. Musunim is from the word matun, to wait, to give. Give time. To wait. be deliberate and slow to judge. V'ha'amidu salmidim harba, and stand up many students. Ba'asu, and make siyag, offense, la Torah, to the Torah. Tomorrow we'll get together and we will talk a little bit more about these three things, and we'll recognize that there is a common thread that binds these three things together, and we'll try and understand why the men of the Great Assembly took these three things above and beyond everything else to emphasize in our pathway to spiritual growth. To be continued. Thank you very much, everyone.